been accused of woking up the military. Someone sent me a T-shirt. You've woked up the military. Well, you know, if you think trying to treat people equally and trying to stop rape is woke, then yes, I am woke. We got over 4,000 responses. We didn't know what the heck had hit us. It was massive. And it was pretty shocking what we found. We had no idea. I had no idea. If you're going to tell me, as a commanding officer of a unit, you have had no discipline problems, then I would say, where are you going wrong? And I would be promoting officers or personnel on how they handle discipline problems, not the fact that they never had them in the first place.
Sarah Atherton was the MP for Wrexham, a defence minister, and a member of the House of Commons Defence Committee. But perhaps she is best known as the author of the Atherton Report, published following the committee's inquiry on the experiences of serving women and veterans from 2021, which is still making change today. Sarah left school at 16 and served as a soldier for 4 formative years before pursuing a master's degree in social work, something she has been dedicated to for many years. We discuss her motivation and drive, as well as leadership, and her journey from Army Corporal to Defence Minister. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Sarah.
I've had an interesting time. It's been an interesting run. Would I do it again? Of course I would. For someone like me, from my background, to suddenly be on the fifth floor in the Ministry of Defence with that influence and power, it was quite an achievement and it was quite a nice little cherry on the top of my life cake, really.
Did you have a plan to find yourself on the fifth floor?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I left school at 16. I had a clutch of O-levels. I had 11 O-levels. I couldn't be bothered getting out of bed to go back to sixth form. My headmaster phoned me up and said, "What are you doing? Where are you? We're expecting you back." And I just wanted to go off into life. I wanted to travel the world. So I didn't do the things that my parents wanted me to do at that time. I didn't go to university. I wanted to be a marine biologist. I didn't do any of that. I sort of drifted for a while and I went to Berlin and I worked in a bar and I was captivated by the Cold War and the military that was there. So I came back and joined the military, joined the army and the intelligence corps.
And how long did you serve in the intelligence corps for?
4 years, not long at all. Very formative 4 years. Thoroughly enjoyed it. But I got married. And we were posted to different countries. And of course, as happens, the woman's career buckles and I followed him. The marriage didn't last much longer than my military career. So, you know, with hindsight, I would have stayed in and made that commitment. But I didn't at the time. That's the sort of the dice that rolls of life, really.
Then you qualified and pursued a career in the health space, I think.
Yes, so I came out of the military. I was at a complete crossroads, didn't quite know what to do. I decided to become a nurse. I trained as a nurse in Wrexham, where I now live. I then became a district nurse. I travelled a bit with that. I went to Scotland. I was the English nurse, district nurse in Culloden, which I always found quite funny. I then became a social worker because actually, when you're treating someone day in, day out because of breathing, respiratory problems, but there's water trickling down the walls on the inside of the house, the two, health and social care, are inextricably linked. So I won a sponsorship. I was sponsored to go to Liverpool University, did a master's in social work, and then became a psychiatric social worker. So my state service spanned 27 years after I left the military.
And what moved you into politics?
I'd always been a social campaigner. I'd always fought for people, but I very much would help people to help themselves and only intervene when they could not do it themselves for the most vulnerable. I was a bit tired. I'd been a single mum for most of my son's life. I thought, you know what, I've had to work. I've been on benefits in my life. I've had insecure accommodation. I thought, you know what, I'm in a position now where I might go part-time. I went part-time and I was absolutely bored stiff. So I decided to become a community councillor. And then it was local elections. And I did that cardinal sin of answering the door at local election time with someone grinning from ear to ear at you. And I was committed because I have a glass sort of kitchen door. And once, you know, he'd seen me through there, I was committed to open this door. So he was Conservative councillor and said, you know, have you thought about voting Conservative? He gave me a leaflet and I said, yes, thank you very much. Yes, I'll read it, promise. Went back in and I did read it. It was saying, you know, it is about a hand up, not a hand out. It is about responsibility for yourself, responsibility for your family, your community, your commitment, your contract, your covenant with society. And I was reading this thinking, well, after 27 years in the state sector, I think I'm a Conservative. He obviously got a hint that I was interested. So he came back and said, well, would you like to meet a few of the volunteers, go out campaigning? And I did. Little did I know, 2 years later, I'd be entering Parliament. And, you know, I'm really lucky. It's a privilege. But it was also a pretty awesome, scary thing to do. I'd left school at 16. I had no interaction with politics at all. Always voted. I'm a woman. Always will vote. But a bit like the Grand National, it's usually on the colour of the livery or the horse. It's usually a dapple that I go for rather than any conscious decision. So there I was in Parliament, didn't know one end of an order paper to another. And I think with hindsight, that has been a refreshing change, has actually geared me up to achieve what I achieved in Parliament, because I wasn't constrained. I was going to speak my mind and do what I thought was right.
Did that relative ignorance of the institution also provide you with a preparedness to challenge it?
Absolutely. And also when I entered the MOD and the use of acronyms, I'd say, oh, you know, forgive me. What does that mean? What do you mean by that? And it was an excuse to do that. We shouldn't have to have an excuse, but it is in these austere environments an excuse to say, what do you actually mean by that? And you know what? Half the time they don't know, particularly in the MOD, they don't know what the acronyms stand for. But then I've always challenged. I've always been that pioneering spirit. I challenged in the military. I certainly challenged 27 years as an advocate for patients and clients in health and social care. So challenging for me is not a problem. It's in my genetics.
Was that what your background and upbringing was like, the determination to challenge or creating conditions where you can challenge?
Well, I think if you ask my parents, I was a pretty difficult child. You know, working in a bar at sort of 17 in Berlin was perhaps, you know, parents' worst nightmare I could imagine. Now I am a parent. My mother was very much a matriarch. She was a district nurse. She went nursing at the age of 14 and nursed all her life. Welsh from Carnarvon. Quite a financially challenged family, but a very, very large family. And family was everything. They were pretty roguish, but they were everything and they would look after each other. And when I say family, it's not just your brothers and sisters. We're talking second cousins. We're talking extended family network. And she instilled that within me. You look after your own. But she very much treated males and females differently. So, for example, growing up, if we went to the chip shop, the chippy, my brothers could have a fish, but I could only have a fish cake because I was the girl and, you know, you've got to be thin for your husband. Plus, the men had the best cut of the meat because they're the ones that were the breadwinners, which was rather mixed up because my mother worked full time all her life. And I was expected to not only study and get a career, but look after the home, look after this mass extended family, and also empty the bins and look after the garden, which is gardening is something I quite enjoyed doing. So it was all very mixed up for me growing up about gender roles. But I was the only girl within a vast amount, a sea of boys. So I very much held my own and saw myself as an equal. And they didn't treat me any differently. I suppose in that mixed picture, I sort of rebelled a little bit and I just wanted to go off and find the world and find myself really and find what my values are. But they are very much rooted in self-responsibility and duty and commitment and hard work.
You talked about your formative years being in your short service in the army, yet you found yourself in the Houses of Parliament as a Member of Parliament, but also on the House Commons Defence Committee. Did that happen almost as soon as you became a Member of Parliament?
Yes, well, I'll put my hands up now. I didn't really know about select committees at all. One of my researchers said, well, why didn't you do defence? What committee do you want to be on? What committees? What do they do? You know, they scrutinise. Great. What do you fancy doing? Defence. and I hadn't thought about it. I automatically assumed it was going to be health and social care that I would be steered into. And then I realised that I was the first female MP in the history of Parliament to have ever had a regular military background.
Really?
And I thought, ooh. Now, having just come out of campaigning for a general election, this is a unique selling point because you have to be elected by your peers onto these committees. So I stood for that, and a few of the older guard within my party sort of said, oh, my dear, you'll have to be around a lot longer than this to get on one of the big committees. And I did it, and I got on the committee immediately, and it was an absolute steep learning curve. I must be the only person that will read my brief from page to page, because for me, it was about learning. But it was really intimidating too. Quite often in politics and in the military, people tend to use long sentences, big words, buzzwords. Why sum something up in three sentences when three paragraphs will do? And how many times have we been to an event where you think this person's been stood up now for 20 minutes? What the heck are they saying? Will you just sit down? And I'm thinking, this is how I should speak. So I was trying to aspire to do that, and I was struggling because it's not me. This is obviously what you have to do to get on in politics. And all, mainly men, are all going, whoa, aren't they great? And I'm thinking, I didn't see that. Actually, for me, they said nothing. But yet my counterparts are saying, well, didn't he speak well? So for many years, I had imposter syndrome, and it wasn't a particularly comfortable time for me. But then the other side of me was, well, you know, you've got a great opportunity here. You've got these values, you're committed. So I was going to do my utmost for my constituents, and I was going to do my utmost for defence. So I had this little dilemma. Part of me saying, you're not good enough, you need to just go away and do public speaking training. And the other part of me is saying, actually, just get stuck in, because there's work that needs to be done here and you can do it. So it's a difficult few years, but I realised actually being me was the best.
You did something quite transformational in setting up the Women in the Armed Forces report. Can you explain how that came about?
So Tobias Elwood was the chair of the committee, and he came to me and said women had been yet again, year on year, overrepresented in the complaint system and missed their recruitment targets. 12%. Would you look into that? Well, of course I would. So I set up a subcommittee. It was left very much to me to design what I was going to do. And I thought, well, I'm a veteran, female veteran myself. No one was even thinking about female veterans. So I wanted to tag on a female veteran element to this inquiry. But also I wanted to speak to service personnel, female service personnel, and then found out we couldn't. Not allowed to do that. You can speak to your MP about potholes outside your house, but you can't speak to them about your service. So then became the challenge of encouraging the MOD to lift the defence instruction notice. Now, what went on will stay between me and the Secretary of State, but he did lift it, and we did have for the first time access to serving personnel. And that was a game changer. We had to encourage the MOD to work with us, which they did. And we started off by opening a quick survey on the MOD intranet site, quick tick box to just sort of get an idea of what was going to go on. And we got over 4,000 responses. We had to get extra staff in. We had to get statisticians in. We didn't know what the heck had hit us. It was massive. And it was pretty shocking what we found. We had no idea. I had no idea. Because my experience in the military, in the intelligence corps, where there were proportionately more females, was really positive, really positive. My husband was in the infantry. I knew there was other sides to life, but my experience had been really good. And we found everything from not having sanitary products on deployment, having to rip up clothing, to initiation ceremonies and gang rape and everything in between. We then had focus groups. We then had witness evidence submitted. So all in all, it was one of the largest committees inquiries in Parliament. 4,106 pieces. That's etched. That's a tattooed on the top of my arm.
There were a whole load of changes resulting from this great work that you did. My understanding is that each year there's an update required to the committee about what progress has been made. Do you think that enough progress has been made? And if not, where would you like to see more progress happen?
So if we just focus on the culture side of it, the military sometimes has a perverse setup that hinders cultural change. I mean, I always say you don't have to be laddish to be lethal, but some of the senior officers involved in transforming or influencing the military perhaps had different ideas and perhaps had come from a different generation to myself. I think through natural progression, things have improved from a senior level, but I would actually say on the ground, it's almost gone backwards. In some areas of the military, there has been a pushback to this. I have been accused of woking up the military. Someone sent me a T-shirt. You've woke up the military. Well, you know, if you think trying to treat people equally and trying to stop rape is woke, then yes, I am woke.
Do you think that the reaction, that regression, is a reaction to this work? And if it is, how do you change that?
So DE&I, I know it's something close to your heart, DE&I, it's pushed through policies very quickly on the back of some shocking evidence that we found in the inquiry. And I don't think they took the time to think about it, think about what the reaction was going to be, what were the consequences, how are they going to get this positive change down to the front line. One thing I noticed as a minister when I walked into this palatial office on fifth floor was the raft of policies that the MOD put in place, all glossy magazines, not one of them linked to each other. Everyone stood alone. I'd never heard of them. I bet your bottom dollar most of the service personnel had not heard of them, or more importantly, were benefiting from them. It is about taking the community with you, thinking about what you're doing. We had the policy in the military flight training, which completely backfired and set us back a long way on transformation when they were favouring women and ethnic minorities over white males. That was a pivotal point when people were saying, this is nonsense, you're woking up the military. This is not what we want. And if you don't take the community with you, and 90% are males, if you don't take the whole of the community with you, then it's never going to work.
Paul Carney, who's just been the Army SOP Major for the last 4 years, in episode one of season two, talked about how the Army doesn't recruit angels, but that there's a determination and a requirement to learn and develop and improve. And also he talked about how the Army has values and standards, and that the recalibration needed to get the best from everyone means that the values and standards are the thing that guide and inform you. Surely that ought to be the start point for making sure everyone's treated well and equally.
Well, that makes an assumption that people come into the military with those values. And if you listen to what the Chief of General Staff said at the last Defence Committee witness session, you know that society has changed. We have toxic masculinity. We have the Trump ripple effect. And society has changed. And of course, the military is going to change as a result of recruiting from society as a bottom-up organisation. I don't actually agree with that. I actually think it's about your morals and your ethics and what you come in to. So, for example, for me, I will challenge anyone if I think it's the right thing to do. I voted against the government because I felt then, and I still feel now, and this was back in 2021, that rape should be heard in a civilian court. And I'd just done this inquiry. That was one of my recommendations. I still stand by that. But then the government, my government at the time, wanted to bring the Armed Forces Bill in and keep rape in the military courts. So I voted against the government. And that took an awful lot of courage and bravery to do that because it was the right thing to do. And now I'm out of Parliament. I am so pleased I did that because it's my conscience that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. So if you've got the right values, you may have been a bit of a rogue. You may have got a checkered background. You may have had a hard background and a hard upbringing. But if you've got those right values, that's all you need because you can build on the rest.
My observation is that the values and the standards don't change for the Army and for the other services too. They ought to be a constant. And so the requirement is to educate and form and train those new recruits from all parts of society to live by those values of the organisation, and that it's the organisation's responsibility to ensure that they live by them, and if they don't, then they should be held to account for it. So in order to have the operational effect that you need from those people serving, you have to have clear values, educated and informed, in order that people live by them and follow them.
I'd absolutely agree. Can't disagree with that at all. And I think it's the military that has to nurture and accept that things aren't always going to go right. People make mistakes, but it's about that nurturing and it's about developing that person, that team, that unit. But then that takes leadership. And that takes motivation from top down. And that takes leaders who are willing to give people a second chance, who are willing to not judge, are willing to give people the psychological safety to make mistakes. The system of promotion for leaders in the military actually doesn't help this. So, for example, we saw the dreadful case of Gunnebeck and how every level of her chain of command let that soldier down. Why did they do it? Because they didn't want to have a unit that had a discipline problem, because that obviously affects their promotion, their own prospects, their own egos, what they want from the military. So what they did was made it go away, ignored it, buried it. There was an awful lot of evidence in my inquiry that said that senior officers were colluding, particularly in sexual cases, so much so that they removed the chain of command from complaints of a sexual nature because they weren't geared up to or capable of or able of or willing to and committed to dealing with that. Because obviously, if you're gunning for that promotion, you don't want to have a black mark against your unit for discipline. That's not their fault. That's the system's fault. And I would, if I was wanting to promote someone, say, well, life is life. People make mistakes. If you're going to tell me, as a commanding officer of a unit, you have had no discipline problems, then I would say, where are you going wrong? And I would be promoting officers or personnel on how they handle discipline problems, not the fact that they never had them in the first place.
And that goes to an honesty and a transparency. But I remember reading from the personal testimony of a serving soldier, female soldier, who wrote in to inform your report. And it's around bystander culture. She wrote, until the observers are punished as severely as those who perpetrate the crimes, the culture will never change. Do you subscribe to that view?
Yes. But the problem we have is that when people have stood up, when people have whistleblown, when people have tried to say this is not on, they have been dealt with in the same negative manner as the victim or the complainant. And this is why 6 out of 10 don't complain, because of the fact that they are so intimidated and they can't get away from that environment. It's a military environment. They are so intimidated. You know, most of these women end up with mental health issues. And that equally goes for if you want to then whistleblow and say, I didn't agree with what happened. It's hard, but she's absolutely right. Until people stand up and say, this has happened, or you watched that happen and you didn't do anything, whether that be your commanding officer or your private, they have to be dealt with the same, and they have to be dealt with quite severely, because it's a deterrent and we need a deterrent factor. I think service personnel are more able to complain or feel empowered to complain. Service police are investigating more sexual complaints. They are sending more to the service prosecution authority, but less are going to court martial. But the conviction at court martial rate for rape has increased. It's nowhere near what the civilian rate is, which isn't good in itself, but it has increased. But of course, they're probably only sending the cases that are probably quite secure with a conviction to court martial. So there's still a lot of stuff going on. But on the face of it, there is a sexual climate within the military culture, not just our military, every military.
This year marks the 25th anniversary of the passing of the UN Security Resolution number 1325, which was around violence against women and girls in conflict. And I came across this quote written in 1995 by Catherine Narcios. Mass rape has been a weapon of war since the beginning of conflict, yet for the most part it has been ignored. History has been just that, his story. Recent evidence in Ukraine and other conflict areas show that that is still happening as a weapon of war. What more work do you think needs to be done to address it?
It would be naive to think it wasn't a weapon of war. Let's look at values. You should not be treating anyone how you would not want to be treated yourself. And how would you feel if your sister, mother, aunt was raped or sexually assaulted? So we need to go back to those core values. And if we have those core values, then this should not be an issue. But it is an issue. Is it society? Is it this toxic masculinity? Is it getting worse? The sexual climate of voyeurism, of sexual assault, they have increased significantly. I think it's always been a problem. I think it's now more visible and it needs to be addressed. It's about the culture, it's about the ethics, it's about leadership. It's complex. We'd be naive to think that it's not a problem because it is used as a weapon in war.
You've achieved enormous successes in your time as a Member of Parliament on the House of Commons Defence Committee. But when you were a minister in the Ministry of Defence, what would be the thing that stood out most for you there?
I had a very effective private office, and one of the chaps would come in, and I wasn't in the MOD for very long, but he would come in at least once, sometimes twice a week, and he'd have a look on his face. I got used to that look. I realised what that look was. And he was coming in to report to me as a minister that there'd been a suicide. And I was shocked. And this is someone that's been a nurse and social worker, a psychiatric social worker. I was shocked at the amount of suicides. I remember looking into that and being firmly told that it's proportionate to civil society. There is nothing different there. And I was thinking, no. I'm not happy with this. I'm not convinced. And I'd say to them, well, you do realise what I did before I came here. There's something not right. This is disproportionate. So I do worry about suicides. I do worry about welfare. And I do worry about sort of the general resilience of our service personnel.
The work that you've been doing has been done through the lens of high-performing teams. I'm interested in understanding whether you see yourself as a leader.
No, I was doing some prep for this and I was listening to your other podcasts and they were talking about leadership and they were articulate and they were fluid and I thought, oh, I'm completely intimidated, complete imposter syndrome. And I thought, well, I'm not a leader. I'm a team player. I'm not a leader. I don't see myself as a leader. But then when I was sort of looking about what leadership is, it's about integrity, it's about courage, bravery. And I think, well, I've got those, but that's just me. That's being a good citizen. That's not being a leader. That's just me treating others how I would want to be treated. If you think that's leadership, then everyone's a leader.
Even those that perhaps don't identify as being leaders can be really effective leaders. The evidence is very clear that whether you want to be a leader or not, you are. It's quite clear that there are thousands of people, women and men, who look to what you've done and see that they want to follow in your leadership style to try and make things better. Quite a lot of our conversation has been in the could do better space. How do you try to get people to focus on the success rather than the perpetual must do better?
So the inquiry set me on a track of trying to resolve issues and problems. We did do a lot of that. There's so much more to do. We also found that 9 out of 10 women, despite everything that we heard, would recommend a career in the military. And I didn't set out on this track to deter women from joining the military because despite everything, I think the military has so much to offer you and for the vast majority of the time, you can have a fantastic career, be treated very equally and be very successful when you leave and go out into civvy street. So I am very conscious that whilst I tackle some of these awful areas of the military, and improvement has been made. I want to celebrate some of the great stories. I mean, we've got our first captain of the Queen Elizabeth, the carrier. Fantastic. That's epic. Jude Terry, epic. Sharon Naismith. We've got some fantastic women now coming up to the ranks based on capability and merit, which is super important because we've got to take the community with us. Progress has been made over the last few years, but there's also things that need adjusting. Military sexual trauma, rape, those need to be addressed. But there's so much good going on. So I want to celebrate our forces and our veterans and say thank you. We need them and they are serving us. So I don't want to detract from that. But equally, I want to make sure that it is the best place it can be.
For everyone.
For everyone.
You mentioned military sexual trauma there, and we'll put in the show notes what the definition of that is. But as I understand it, the Ministry of Defence is not recognising military sexual trauma. Can you explain why you think that's unhelpful?
Yes, it was very evident that military sexual trauma happens. The military element of the sexual trauma is because it happens in a certain environment, a very different environment to anything else, because you can't get away from the perpetrator. Many nations have adopted this term, but until you adopt it and say, yes, it is happening, then nothing's really going to change. And the MOD will not budge on accepting that term. It didn't budge when I was a minister. It didn't budge when I was in the Defence Committee. And I'm not seeing it budging now under new administration, which is a shame. Because until you accept this, and many of our allies and NATO allies do accept it, we're not going to see real improvement.
And that has a enormous impact on those people who've endured the awful experience of military sexual trauma, because it not only doesn't validate their experience, but also it doesn't allow them to get beyond that, or indeed for the institutions to take the appropriate actions and initiatives to make things better, not just when these things happen, but also before they happen.
There's only one charity run by women for women, and that's Salute Her. And I first met Salute Her when I was taking evidence and I had service women phoning me up, suicidal. And I thought, wow, I can't put the phone down. I can't put the phone down on these women. I've got to find something here to support them. And I phoned a number of charities. Many said, well, we'll have to go to the board. We'll have to wait. We'll have to, you know, do this, that and the other. And I was getting the brush off and I phoned this small charity up who had 75 women on their books at the time who had experienced military sexual trauma. And they said, yes, send them our way. We will help them. And I'll always advocate for Salute Her for that reason. They've got 5,000 on their books now since 2021. So you can't tell me it is not happening and it's not real.
I just worry about those people that don't know where to go to. So those people haven't perhaps heard of Salute Her. How do they find out where they should go to get the right support?
That's a real big issue, because if a woman is raped in the military, they can go to the civilian police. But when I talk to service personnel and say, just by the way, do you know, if it ever happens, they don't know. And this is this whole thing about filtering the information down to the coalface where it's needed. And this is this whole business about sitting on the fifth floor in the MOD with this raft of policies. And actually, service personnel don't know what their welfare rights are. So it is about filtering that information down. Progress is being made, but it is an issue with the military about the rights and welfare of service personnel. And do they know what they are eligible for?
The new government brought in as a manifesto commitment the establishment of an Armed Forces Commissioner. Do you think that's a good thing?
The Armed Forces Commissioner could be transformational. And one thing I was complimented on through doing the inquiry was giving service women and men a voice for the first time. If the commissioner and the commissioner's office is genuine, if it has teeth, if it has power and influence, if the person appointed has the right values and motivations, and if it is genuinely set up to do good work and not be tokenistic, then it could really transform the situation for service personnel. Because if it doesn't, there is a call, and it's a call where the voices are getting stronger to unionise the military, like they have done in Scandinavian countries. Now, I'm not in favour of that, but equally, the reason why we want an effective, ready military is because they might be called upon. But also, it's about recruitment and retention. And this is an opportunity to help them and to resolve some of these endemic issues that are flowing under the surface of the MOD.
I've had a number of people suggest that a perfect candidate for the role as Armed Forces Commissioner is Sarah Atherton. Is that a role that you could see yourself doing?
I think it would be an absolute opportunity for me, with my skills and experience, to do that role. Of course, I would love to do that role. Would I do a good job? Yes, I would. Would I hold the values of our service personnel at heart and work towards those? Yes, I would. Would I be something that the government would want? Don't know. But would I do a good job, and would I serve our military as they serve our country? Yes, I would.
Sarah is reflective, honest, and clearly committed to leaving no women behind. Her campaigning and call to arms is clear. Despite her positive personal experiences while serving in the army, her seminal report acted as a catalyst for change. She recognizes that there is still more work to be done, particularly around culture change. I especially liked her line, "You don't have to be laddish to be lethal." I enjoyed her observation that far too frequently people use jargon and complicated language in defence, something many of us have been guilty of in the past. I recall a commanding officer of mine demanding we used Anglo-Saxon and not Latin words. I found her reflection about leadership instructive. What stood out for you? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Thanks for listening. Take care until next time.